Subcommittee on Natural Resources for January 24th, 2007. We have agency overviews today for the Oregon State Marine Board, the Parks and Recreation Department, and the Department of Forestry. Due to time constraints, although it appears to be very difficult in some cases, we will keep the presentations to 20 minutes each with about 5 to 6 minutes for questions. And reminding everyone that this is just an overview. No decisions are being made here today. In fact, I don't have a quorum either on the Senate or the House side to make any decisions on anything today.
Well, the House is well.
We'll see. I think I get a quorum on the House just as I speak.
That's even better.
So with that, we will start off with the director of the State Marine Board, Mr. Don Hefner. Is that how it's pronounced? Or? Close,
Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to introduce Lisa Pearson. She's our budget analyst with Department of Administrative Services. And with me this morning, too, is Randy Henry. He's our policy and planning analyst. So if I can, I'd like to start with our... Okay. I hope you can read this.
Some of the younger people here probably can't
remember. We are the Marine Board. We're the voting agency for the state of Oregon. Our mission is dedicated to safety, education, and public access in an enhanced environment. We were created in 1959. We have a 5-member board, 39 employees. We're based here in Salem. We have over 187,000 direct customers, all the motorboats and sailboats that are registered with us. In addition to that, there's another 500,000 non-motorized boats in the state that also receive some of the benefits of safety and education and access from our programs. Oregon ranks 26th in the nation, nationwide in total boats registered. We're 28th in population, so boating is popular here. There are nearly 60 registered boats for every 1,000 people in the state. The good news, we don't receive any general fund support. We are entirely other fund and federal fund. A little bit of the dimensions of boating in Oregon. It is a small boat state for the most part. You can see here that these first three bars represent boats less than 20 feet, so clearly the majority of the boats in this state are small boats, trailerable, portable, and move around the state. In terms of types of propulsion, 62% are outboard powered, 34% inboard, the rest are sail and other. And then in terms of float boats, we've got a whole plethora of those, rafts, kayaks, canoes, drift boats, and other types that make up the composition of people that play on our waterways. In terms of boating use, the green bars here represent state population. That continues to increase. About 1998, we hit a plateau in terms of boat use. That's in red, and we had a decline. We've had several years of drought, poor fishing conditions, and other things that have attributed to a drop-off. But in our last, most recent survey, boating use ticked back up. There are over 3 million days of boat use each year around the state. Fishing is the primary, one of the primary activities that people participate in. That makes up 2/3 of all the boating use, water skiing, and cruising at 13% and 17%. Some of the most popular waterways in the state, no surprise, the Columbia, the Willamette, the Pacific Ocean. But then we move to the larger lakes and reservoirs. Detroit is fourth. Lake Billy Chinook in Central Oregon is the fifth most popular body of water. And then down the list to the top 10 include Rogue River, the Umpqua, Lost Creek, Multnomah Channel, and Tillamook Bay. Just a high-level view of our budget. It's broken into three program areas. That's how we lay it out. Administration and education, $5.8 million. Law enforcement, $13.7 million. Facilities construction, $14.3 million. for an overall budget of $33 million. And this is how it breaks out. About equal shares between law enforcement facilities, 41 and 42%. Administration and education combined at 17%. Summary of our programs. I mentioned we have the three program areas, administration and education. Within this, we do our boat registration and titling business. We register guides and outfitters. There are about 1,200 of those that we register around the state. Ocean charter boats are covered within that. We have our boating safety and education programs under administration and education, an abandoned boat program, and a marina program round out that area. Then our marine law enforcement program, and then finally boating facilities and public access. Going a little deeper into the administrative area, we do most of our business through agents that we have around the state, 124 bonded agents. These are boating businesses, boat dealers, businesses like G.I. Joe's and others that issue temporary permits for us. I mentioned 188,000 boats registered. We also title floating homes and boathouses within that program. Outfitter and guide registration, we have a little over 1,000 outfitters and guides, 212 charter boats. We issue events, marine event permits for boat races, regattas, things like that, in conjunction with the Coast Guard. We carry out waterway regulatory marking and rulemaking, posting the waterways with buoys, as well as establishing administrative rules for speed, no wake, to control conflicts and minimize the risk to users. We carry out boating surveys to take snapshots of where people are going and what they're doing on the waterways. And then we round out administration with our we have personnel management and business services. Peeling a little further back into boating safety education, these are some of the things that we carry out within that. One of the biggest activities is the issuance of boater education cards under our mandatory education program. We train volunteer instructors, produce a variety of high-quality publications to inform the public about boating safety and where to go, what to do. Public service ads. We have a junior boater program. We investigate boat accidents to find the causes and try to learn from those accidents so that we can come up with new interventions to improve safety on the waterways. And then we have a variety of other things, media things, school classes, signs and kiosks, public information. And we coordinate with a lot of other resources, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, other volunteer organizations that promote boating safety. We also have a fairly new initiative within the last 2 years, a Clean Marina program. This is designed to promote best management practices at marinas to prevent non-point source pollution that comes from boats and boat yards and marinas. So far, we're very pleased. We have 36 marinas that have pledged to participate in the program. It is a voluntary program. And so far, we've certified eight. In fact, we're today doing in the Portland area, Columbia Crossings, which is River Place, Tomahawk Bay, Hayden Bay, and Jansen Bay Marina are being certified today. So we have over 2,000 slips covered with that program already certified. It does help the state meet our NOAA objectives for reducing marina-related pollution in the coastal zone. We work with DEQ and Land Conservation and Development Commission with their coastal zone program on promoting best management practices. It provides outreach and support, and we have the opportunity to provide financial assistance to some of these marinas for infrastructure things that help them to comply with best management practices. So it's off to a good start, and we're very encouraged by the participation. We've got both public and private marinas that are participating in that program. Mandatory boater education is one of the key things that we've been doing for the last several years. To date, we've got over 150,000 people that have been certified in the state as receiving boating education. We still have over 115,000 that are yet to go. So we're well over halfway there. This year, it includes persons age 60 and under. We've been phasing it in over the last several years, and we've got a few more years of phase in. We've got 61 volunteers that are certified to teach the classes, statewide, a variety of course providers. The internet option has proven to be one of the most popular options for people to take the course and become certified. And then we're, I guess, proud of the fact that a number of other states have taken our idea and run with it. Washington enacted a law last year. They're implementing it this year, which is essentially Oregon's law. They modeled theirs after ours. California is looking at a law this year that's based on ours, and several other states have come to visit to see how we're doing things here. So I think it's a fairly model program, and it's going well. Child PFD safety initiatives. This is an exciting thing that we've done over the last couple of years with the O'Loughlin trade shows. They sponsor the Portland Boat Show. And for the last 2 years, in cooperation with Mustang Survival, the National Safe Boating Council, ourselves, Coast Guard, and the volunteers, they have purchased 5,000 life jackets for the last 2 years to give away free to children that attend the Portland Boat Show. So we gave away 5,000 last year. This year, over 3,000 were given away at the show. Kids go through a junior boater program where they learn some basics about boating safety. It's been a real hit. It's won a number of national honors, the Pillars of Support Award from the Coast Guard and the National Safe Boating Council, the NASBLA Award for Public Service, and it's also been recognized by the National Water Safety Congress for water safety in the Northwest. It's the only effort that we're aware of in the nation where a trade show has stepped up to purchase that many. It's quite a financial participation on their part to give that many jackets away. So that's an important part of our child safety initiatives. Then switching gears out of administration and education to our marine law enforcement program. In this program, we provide funding for 32 counties and the state police under contract. We provide them with law enforcement patrol boats and equipment. We train and certify marine law enforcement officers. We put on a number of training sessions throughout the year to do that. We coordinate our waterway marking system, enforce state laws and administrative rules, assist in the education program. Marine officers are an important part of our overall education effort. They're integrated with it, and they help us conduct our school and adult water safety education programs. Moving into our last program area, boating facilities. In this, we provide grants and technical assistance to local governments, cities, counties, park districts, port districts, state parks, other agencies, to assist with the construction and maintenance of boating facilities, launch ramps, parking areas, restrooms, docks, tie-ups, those types of things come under this, this program. We also provide grants for sewage pump-out stations, under the Federal Clean Vessel Act program, and funding for tie-up docks under the Boating Infrastructure Grant programs for large boats to provide them destination tie-up facilities. That's been a very popular program as well. Projects are given statewide on a competitive basis. Typically needs and requests exceed dollars available by several times over. And we do have a six-year plan that helps identify the needs. The most recent plan identifies over $150 million in boating infrastructure needs through 2011. And we provide coordination, engineering, and technical assistance to local sponsors to get those projects done. Very popular program with local governments and others, and an important part of maintaining public access to our waterways around the state. And finally, wrapping up, just wanted to share some of the continuous improvements that we're trying to make in some of our programs. I know this may be a little hard to read, but RegLine is our online renewal of vessel registrations. We went with e-commerce a few years ago. It kicked off in 2002, 2003 for just a partial year, but since then we've done 8,000 or almost 9,000 renewals, 16,000 renewals. Last year it dropped off to 11 because we had quite a bit of downtime as they shifted from our provider to e-commerce or to EDS. But this year we're back up over 7,500 so far, so we're 21% ahead of last year in terms of people renewing online. And So that's great, getting stronger all the time. We've added two new interactive databases that can be accessed 24/7 for our online database of voters, so that agents and other authorized users can gain access to our information around the clock. It's less calls to us and better service to them. And we've done the same for outfitter and guide registrations. We put that information online for authorized users. Last year, we had over 3,200 hours of volunteer support for education programs, which was 1.5 FTE that was contributed to agency programs by volunteers. We've contracted out support of our 7410 breath testing equipment within the law enforcement program. That's resulted in an annual savings of $40,000. We've shifted some of our marine law enforcement training from the postseason to our preseason meeting. We've saved over 1,000 hours there at a cost of cost savings of over $62,000. And in our facilities program, we're proud of the fact that we've received a number of kudos in this last year from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state's Organization for Boating Access for excellence in boating facilities design, construction, and management. So that program is a leader in its field as well. And that is a very quick overview of our agency, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have of us.
Any questions for the director?
Mr. Chair, just one quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you a member of the Invasive Species Council? Is that the term?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, yes, we have been a participant in that. Randy Henry, who's sitting behind me, is very active with invasive species. It's one of the things that we're watching very carefully, and we're working presently with the House Agriculture Committee on a bill to help reduce the spread of that vis-a-vis boat trailers.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I did have one question. You identified fishing as the major use for boats that you have registered. Senator Schrader and I, and Senator Metzger, and I believe probably others, have attended a few meetings around the metropolitan region with angry anglers, guides, and outfitters. Basically reflecting around people making major investments in boating equipment, et cetera, and having shorter seasons or no seasons. Have you ever done any analysis on the economic impact of boating in Oregon? And how well-founded do you think those concerns are? I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of the industry's concerns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is a serious issue, and it is something that we've looked at in the past. It's been a number of years since we've done an actual economic analysis of the impacts of boating in Oregon, but at the time it would have been the 13th biggest industry in the state if it was taken together as one. It was well over $1 billion worth of value between manufacturing, sales, support, and the rest of it. And we know that there is a relationship between good fishing seasons and people getting out on the waterway. So those concerns that the sport fishing industry and the guides and manufacturers and others have are, I think, well-founded.
And I would like to say that I've never heard anything but good things about your agency. So, any additional questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I put before you sort of the text of the Overview of the organization. I'm just going to kind of hit some of the highlights and be happy to answer any questions that you might have as we go through.
Please proceed.
The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is organized to provide and protect outstanding natural, scenic, cultural, historic, and recreational sites for the enjoyment and education of past and future generations, and that's the mission statement under which we operate. The department became a separate agency in 1990. Its origins was in the State Department of Transportation, and so since 1990 we've been organized and functioned as a separate agency. Besides operating state parks across the state, we also are responsible for managing the state's ocean shore recreation area, the 362 miles of ocean shore that the state has on the Pacific, and the Oregon State Scenic Waterway Program. Additionally, in the current biennium, we took on the responsibility of managing the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center. Our authorities for our organization are established in the Constitution with regard to dedicated lottery fund, and then in several statutes that cover recreation management as well as heritage preservation and also the state fair. By statute, the department is governed by a seven-member, governor-appointed, Senate-confirmed commission. Those seven members, five of the seven members come from the congressional districts across the state, and one from east of the Cascades and one from west of the Coast Range and one from east of the Cascades. And the chair of our commission, Bill Gregory, is with us today. Our commission is a decision-making commission, a policy-setting commission, and has responsibility for establishing the budget goal, reviewing the financial situation, and making decisions about the budget of the department, promoting outdoor recreation. They have the authority to acquire real property and to adopt administrative rules. We meet 6 to 8 times at various locations around the state. In 2000, the commission adopted what we call Target 2014. The 8 points of Target 2014 are listed there at the bottom of page 2. And that's basically the strategy that we adopted to guide the agency through the time period of which the dedicated lottery fund was available to the agency. We're organized into 5 different sort of organizational units. We have what we call operations. Operations is the section, probably the single largest part of our department. They're responsible for operating and maintaining our state park systems, maintenance and improvement of those systems. They also manage our safety, our sustainability program, and our properties and natural resource programs within operations. The Heritage Programs Division in our department is kind of twofold. It is there as the agency or the organization that administers the responsibilities that the state has under the National Historic Preservation Act, second hat that I wear as director of the department is as the state historic preservation officer. And we also have other statewide programs regarding protection of historic resources, preservation of historic resources, the historic cemeteries program, historic trails program. We work with tribes and museums across the state in that regard assisting them in preserving the state's heritage. Another organizational unit we have is what we call Recreations Programs and Planning. They do the master planning for the department, recreation research necessary to support the planning effort. They also administer the Community Grants Program, the All-Terrain Vehicle Grants Program, our Recreation Trails Program, interpretation, and manage our volunteer program, of which we have probably about 220 FTE worth of volunteer support annually that comes through hosts and others who volunteer to do work in state parks. The state fair is another organizational unit. It includes not just the 2-week state fair, but the year-long operation of the exposition center, and then the administration department, which is sort of the business functions of the organization. At the bottom of page 3, you'll see a pie chart that just kind of shows what our revenue sources are, what percentage of they make up of our total revenue stream, and our expenditures as we've proposed in the governor's recommended budget. We, as Paul Bonhefter mentioned in his presentation, we get some transfers from agencies like Department of Transportation for some maintenance of park roads. We also do contract work for the Department of Maintenance or Department of Transportation for some waysides, rest areas, and then we also get money from the Marine Board for development, operation, and maintenance of some boating facilities that exist in state parks. So as you look at that chart, you'll notice that there is no general fund in the department budget. Our revenue history is highlighted there on page 4. Generally, park visitor fees have been flat over the past 10 years or so. We've had no increases to our day use, expansion of our day use fee program, nor have we had any increases in the rate of which we've charged, nor increases in rates of camping fees that we've charged in the department for at least the last 10 years. So our fee structure that you see there, where it says park visitors fees, is based on a stable sort of fee structure that has existed over time. Lottery profits, as you notice on there, has continued to grow since the Target 20, or since the lottery Measure 66 was passed in 1998, and so lottery has continued to become a growing percentage of our revenue stream. We also pass some federal funds through to other agencies. Grant programs through, and basically that's through the National Historic Preservation Act. We have some grant monies that we provide local communities for establishment of certified local governments, and some of that money that comes to us from the feds for Recreation Trails Program and for the National Historic Preservation Program is used to manage our responsibilities for managing the National Register of Historic Properties and other federal programs related to that. We also get funds, federal funds, from the national or from the Federal Land and Water Conservation Program. It's a grant program. Those monies are passed through us to other agencies. The amount of money in that program is dwindling, and there may be none in the coming biennium in Land and Water Conservation Fund. Each year we serve about 40 million visitors. About 2.5 million campers come to participate in state parks, either through for hiking, for camping, for nature activities, for various kinds of outdoor activities. So we manage a system of over 200 and some parks themselves that are over 200 and some properties across the state that are very well visited. We also are the lead advocate for outdoor recreation in the state. And so as we've benefited from increased growth in lottery over the past several years, we've been able to sort of expand our role in being an outdoor recreation advocate from what it has been in the past. And in doing so, we work with local communities in developing partnerships and passing money through and joint planning efforts to plan and promote for outdoor recreation in the state. A couple of examples that are listed there on page 5 is the recent Willamette Valley Scenic Bikeway, which is an outdoor recreation opportunity that's been developed in cooperation with local communities, some nonprofit organizations to promote bicycling in the state of Oregon and to get folks out and into the countryside. The other example is the Willamette River Water Trail. Two sections of the three sections of the trail have been dedicated. The third section will be dedicated this year, but it's working with local interest groups, local communities, and other local park and recreation providers to provide recreation opportunities without regard to who the agency is that might be administering that. One of the great advantages that we've had from the lottery, and one of the initial purposes of the lottery fund, was to build down the backlog of maintenance and repair that existed in parks prior to 1998. We had about $120 million in backlog of maintenance and repair at that time, and at the end of this biennium, we should have that down to about $48 million, and our plan is to have it to zero by the end of the life of Measure 66, which would be 2014. We've been pretty successful in doing that, and in the years that we've been involved in this, that's like 800 and some projects that we've undertaken from various levels of difficulty, from re-roofing a small building to major reconstruction of campgrounds. So that's been a high need area for us, too. One of the other areas that we've used lottery for is property acquisition, acquiring properties to either preserve them for their value, if they're heritage properties, as well as to meet future recreation needs. And a couple of examples of properties that we've purchased to meet that need in the current biennium would be the Cougar Valley Park that we've acquired over on the Nehalem River, and a historic property down near Wolf Creek called Golden. It's a ghost town, abandoned gold mining town, and another significant piece of property that fronts on the Columbia River at near Ainsworth State Park. Also under construction, we have Stubbs Stewart State Park up in Washington County, about a 1,600-acre park, which will open in June of this year, the first new full-service state park that we've built in our system since Cape Blanco back over 30 years ago. So that's how those funds are being invested. Additionally, you know, we worked with other agencies and developed Sunset Beach State Park, which is the oceanside trailhead to the Fort Sea Trail that exists over on the North Coast. Another key part of how we invest that money, that lottery money, is through through grants to local communities. And since we've had the lottery money, we've invested over $20 million in local communities, parks and recreation facilities, to assist them in developing new playgrounds and essentially improving the livability of their communities. Most grants range anywhere from $10,000 up to as much as $500,000. As you might guess, that's a pretty popular program with local park and recreation providers and governments. As I mentioned, Historic Preservation Office is responsible for the state's responsibilities for compliance with the National Historic Preservation Act. But one of the key roles that we think we want to expand, improve upon, if you will, in our heritage programs is providing assistance to those folks who have historic resources that they want to preserve and protect. How can we assist them by providing technical assistance, grants, and those sorts of things to help them accomplish that? Rather than just coming to us as a sort of a regulatory agency under the National Historic Preservation Act, we want to be outreach in that regard and help folks find ways to do that. As I mentioned, in 2006, we were responsible for the Oregon State Fair. We undertook a planning process at the end of the last biennium, made some significant changes to the fair, have developed a business plan that will carry us out into the future with regard to the fair, and we want to make it successful. In 2006, the improvements we made resulted in about a 10% increase in revenue and a 10% increase in attendance and a considerable high level of satisfaction of those who participated. So we think that's on the right track. On page 7, the Protecting Vital Places really refers to our responsibilities for ocean shore management and protection of the ocean shore recreation area, our administration of the Oregon Scenic Waterways Program. We have permitting responsibilities under both of those programs. So what's ahead? Our budget request, as you'll be looking at that in the future, will support what we've identified, sort of what the issues are that face the department in the future. First of all, with increasing population, there's an increasing demand on recreation facilities, as you can imagine, statewide. So one of the things that we want to do is be sure that the facilities and parks that we have meet the needs of folks, as well as we need to acquire, as population grows, we need to acquire properties, build parks to meet those needs in the future. You know, the national average for visitors to state parks is 69 visitors per acre. In Oregon, that average is 442 visitors per acre. And one of our key performance measures has to do with benchmark 90, which calls for 35 acres per 1,000 population. And right now, we're at about 27 acres per 1,000. And really, the national average is up at about 47.3. So we've got a ways to go, and we'll talk to you about a plan that we have to help get us in moving in that direction as we move forward in the next several biennium. Also, as I mentioned, one of our interests is to boost support for heritage preservation across the state. Our participation in the Oregon's bicentennial, sesquicentennial, which is coming up, is key to that. But also, we want to be provide assistance to folks, as I mentioned, who are interested in preserving historic properties across the state. Also, one of the issues with the growing use of all-terrain vehicles across the state for recreational purposes, there's a growing injury rate, questions regarding safety and so forth, that since we are the program agency responsible for the ATV program across the state, we think looking at some of the issues regarding the growing activities and the safety needs around the ATV program is important and should be on our horizon. And then the last item there on the bottom of page 9 is looking beyond the boundaries, as I said, of our state parks to work with others to promote outdoor recreation, to promote the connection of youth and get them engaged in outdoor recreation early in their lifetime so that they have an innate desire and interest, in outdoor activities, the values that go with that. And so we've been doing some research as we're updating our statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan to look at what needs are and how we might address that. And then the last item on the challenge there on page 10 is building on the success of the 2006 fair. As I mentioned, we've conducted a whole series of interviews across the state over the last year and a half and our commission has adopted a pretty robust business plan, if you will, for the state fair. And our intent is to operate the state fair as an enterprise and see if we can make it at least break even over some period of time. So we have our business plan really has two elements. That's how do we address the two-week state fair, the thing that most people are familiar with. But the other 50 weeks of the year is a very important opportunity to make good use of the facilities that exist on the fairground. And, in fact, we're working very closely with the mayor of the city of Salem and city staff at working with ways to figure out how the state fairgrounds and the other 50 weeks of the year can complement the city of Salem and how we mutually can benefit from doing that. And that's been real productive, and it's been real positive. The last challenge I think we have is the same challenge that faces many state agencies across the state, and that is being sure that we have an organizational structure that's vibrant and capable of accomplishing the agency's missions over the long run. That talks to issues of high rates of or high eligibility for retirement. Having key well-trained staff, being able to recruit good staff and retain them, and I think that's a challenge, the succession planning issue, if you will, that faces many state agencies, faces our agency as well. Go back to my reference earlier about the aging baby boomer population. Well, I don't think that's me, but that's a lot of people that work in our agency. So that's an overview of the agency. I know there's a lot to cover. We're excited to talk to you about what we have proposed in the next biennium and interested to get your feedback in that. And I think you'll see that our budget presentation is pretty much built around what we have identified as the challenges. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have four questions for Mr. Wood, if that's okay. Thank you. First of all, Mr. Wood, thanks for being here today. And I, having spent 5 years on the Park Board in Bend, have grown very familiar with your department and really support what you do. And I also want to say that the most recent addition of Brad Chalfon to your commission, I think, is a wonderful one. Brad's going to be an excellent addition. I've come to work with him very closely on trying to implement the Community Forest Authority in Central Oregon, and I think Brad does a great job. I'm glad he's on your commission. Couple questions. First, the ATV fund, and you don't have to give me this now, but I would like to ask. I'd like to see the breakdown on that, the revenue expenses and ending fund balances. And I'd like a little bit more information on the
committee that you have. I'm not real familiar with it, who's on it, what they do, but I've had some constituents express some frustration about that. They, you know, say they're putting money in and don't feel like they're getting money back, and now they're on the ground maintenance and restoration activities. So I'd like some more information on that. Second question, the Schutz River Boater Pass is listed as a revenue source. I'd be curious, after the implementation of the limited entry common pool system on the lower Deschutes, if that's had any effect on use and consequently on the revenue aspect.
The imposition of the limited entry.
Right.
Piece. Okay.
Yes. Third question, the bicycle promotion. If I recall, during the interim, you were trying to get from the e-board some funding for, I believe, an FTE to promote bicycling as recreation and destination for tourists in Oregon. Did you get that funding, or is that in here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, we made a presentation talking about the program. We did not make a request for a position, nor did we make a request for funds. However, we do have a request. That's one of our budget requests, packages in our budget request.
Great, thank you. And then last, the state fair, and I think the development of a business plan is a wonderful idea. I'm curious if in that business plan, if you have any projection on, because one of the things listed in your, the budget overview here is that part of the business plan strategy is to meet all expenses for the fair, including operations and maintenance from revenue generated by the enterprise. Do you have any projection as to when that might occur?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it's probably 5 years out. We've run some numbers and looked at that, and it's dependent upon a lot of things. One of the greatest new revenue sources we're being able to develop is sponsorships for fair facilities and activities and programs, and that's becoming very promising in that regard. We still have a $4.2 million debt service, biennial debt service requirement in our budget that goes to retiring the debt on basically facilities investments that were made at the fair. That's going to be the tough piece to, that's going to be a tough one to get to. But we're looking at, like I said, some of these ideas about redevelopment work with the City of Salem and whatever. There's some promise out there, but it's at least 5 years out, likely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Wood. And for somebody who greatly enjoys their state parks, I really believe they're a real asset for our state. And if you, I'm sure for folks who've traveled to other states, realize how unique it is that we have such a comprehensive state park system here. A couple of questions regarding Measure 66 funds, and as you mentioned, they expire in 2014. We certainly hope that we'll be able to get that renewed, but given that, that will have to go back to the voters, and we don't have any certainty about whether that will be renewed or not. What's your plan, since 44% of your funding comes from lottery, obviously no general fund at this time, what's your plan? Are you working with the commission to develop a plan now for how you would replace those funds? And I know you mentioned that they're currently going to the maintenance and backlog, but with all the new parks coming online, I mean, that's not going to go away. So if you could talk about that a little bit, I'd appreciate
sure.
It.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, that's a very, very good question. What we have tried to do is fund our sort of our park system portion of our operations out of the other funds, which are user fees and revenue we generate from permits and user fees and those kinds of things, to fund basically our park system. And the bulk of the lottery money has gone to it has augmented operations and it has supported some new programs. But the bulk of it has gone into the land acquisition program that we didn't have prior to Measure 66, and into the local grants program that we didn't have prior to Measure 66. So one of the things we're looking at is looking at come 2014, if we're successful in reducing the backlog to zero, then the need to put lottery money into backlog of maintenance and repair is is not there. So that's, you know, that's a portion of sort of today's budget that wouldn't exist in the future. That need wouldn't be there in the future. To address that backlog, we're also, one of the things we're going to talk to you about in the budget process is establishment of a sinking fund, which will allow us to start putting some money away in a sinking fund to meet those future preventive maintenance needs that we will have. But frankly, at some point in about 97, 99, there was about $11 million in general fund in the agency's budget. The agency, frankly, wasn't very well funded prior, at that time and prior to that time for a whole host of reasons. And so we're going to need to look at making up a portion of the loss of lottery revenue to operate the systems. That's going to be a policy decision that hopefully would be based on some recommendations that would come from our Parks and Recreation Commission, but also ultimately would be decisions you all would make. Our goal is to try to keep that. There are other things, like we could raise fees, expand programs, reduce programs, there are cost-cutting measures and other, other things. But, whether it would be appropriate, determined to be appropriate, I guess, to support the agency's budget with general fund or to support it with unmitigated lottery, some other revenue source, I mean, that's very likely a decision that's going to have to be made in about 2014, if the lottery revenue isn't reestablished. If I could just, I know we're probably in more detail here than I intended to be.
I just had a quick follow-up. And sure. The concern I have is that we need to be coming up with recommendations before 2014 because, I mean, a 44% drop in revenue is pretty significant. And I know that, like you said, a lot of that's going to programs that may not be here.
Right.
However, with the growing population, we will be probably continuing to look at acquisition.
Right.
There will be maintenance. I mean, I think right. What I'm asking is, has the commission or will the commission be looking at recommendations to the legislature for how we can transition if Measure 66 is
Mr. Chair, the answer is yes. We are looking at that, and we're looking at what the options are. We're looking at what the impact might be. So it's not something we're going to wait until 2013 and throw on your desk. That wouldn't be responsible on our part. So, yes, the answer is yes, and I'd be glad to talk to you in more detail about what we're doing and how we're looking at that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had just a couple questions. One regarding the, I forget the term for it, but I think it's your historic preservation function. Do you actually work with sites where there are like Native American remains?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, yeah, we work with landowners and who have archaeological resources on their sites. There is in statute some requirements on how to deal with significant archaeological resources, and we work with the landowners and local jurisdictions that are involved in that. Yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is, as you may know, and I just wanted to see if you're A, already involved in this, or B, if not, especially with kind of the spirit of your words about assistance versus just pure regulatory. The City of Salem is going to be hopefully looking at an issue with the Boise Cascade property where there are suspected to be remains, serious remains, and yet the city would like to do something that honors and follows the law, certainly, but honors in a way that I think is the spirit of what you're talking about, but also see what can be done to have an industrial use turned into something that benefits the population. And so I would like to see, because I like your philosophy on it, and I would like to make sure you're able to help if possible.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, that's a good question. Just because there are significant archaeological remains identified on a site doesn't mean that development or use of the site can't go forward. And we like to work with folks to help them get through that. I mean, there are ways to mitigate that. And like you said, our staff role is to help folks find an answer to those issues.
A different question. And please keep me abreast on that particular project if you do get involved. And the state fair, you're talking to our mayor a lot already, and so that would be good. Mr. Chair, the other question had to do with the state fair. I just wanted to say I'm pleased to hear the words future and successful. I also, and you may already again be doing this, but I would like to see the Grand Oregon concept and the work that's done and the money's been spent employed as well, because I've seen some really great logos that are made in Oregon, grown in Oregon, built in Oregon that have been developed, and I can see those things as banners around the state fair that are themes, and I know we're spending a lot of money and work on Brand Oregon. It seems like the state fair is the perfect place to showcase it. That's all I got. Thank you.
Director Wood, there are a couple requests that I would have. The first one would be 1980, when the state parks were taken off the gas tax. Could you give me, not here today, the approximate number of acres of parkland that we had in the state system per thousand?
The approximate number that you've already stated now that we have currently per thousand. And should we not add a significant additional land to the park system, the amount that we would be projected to have with our current population projections for 2040, which is about, my memory is correct, about 5.4 million people in the state.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we can do that.
And then I wanted to actually give the committee a preliminary notification about something that has not been decided. And there are good reasons decisions are made, and I think if this decision is made, we should just simply be prepared for it, and it's simply the way the Ways and Means process works. Hidden within the state parks budget is an allocation to the Oregon Historical Society, something many of us treasure. There is a possibility that particular item will be broken out and actually transferred over to the Economic Development Subcommittee. So I just wanted to put you aware of, to make you aware of that as part of the committee. And you'll obviously still have a chance to vote on it on the floor, or if you're in the full committee, you'll have a chance to vote there. But that portion may be broken out from this budget and transferred over to that subcommittee.
Chair?
Yes.
If I'm understanding right, the proposal that I saw is to fund that through Measure 66 money, the capital funds,
Mr. Chair,
or is that the non-capital?
It is intended to be lottery funded, right, through the Measure 66.
Measure 66 resources are for any park purpose, so they're unrestricted as long as they meet the definitions within the Constitution.
And that's probably subject to interpretation, but the original measure did spell out that they could use it for historical purposes. And so
that's probably a closer definition than using them for the state police.
So, Chair, how does that compare with the testimony we had yesterday where the Watershed Board, 65% has to go for capital? Does the parks have any sort of...
No. They do not.
No, that's the other
side
of Measure 6. Okay. Senator Nelson, that's the other side of Measure 6.
That's the other side. Okay, so one agency has a capital construction requirement. This agency does. Okay, that's a good point.
One of the things that I think people should understand, too, about the Measure 66,
I mean, we're probably going to have to get a legal opinion someday on this, my understanding of the measure is the measure has to be referred back in its current form back to the public in 2014. There's probably an open question whether the legislature could simultaneously refer an alternative, but for all practical purposes, the measure that was passed by the voters has to be referred back to them for their decision in 2014. And I think, just speaking as one individual on this committee and as one member of the legislature, I think actually that addressing the backlog of deferred maintenance is a very good thing to do. I think potentially planning for the decline in that fund is a good thing to do. But I don't think it should be done in the absence of having a vigorous acquisitions program that gets us in a better situation in terms of meeting the needs of citizens.
The one other thing I would ask about the, if you have this data, it's hard data to get, but is the level of tourist visits to state park facilities in 1980 versus now.
When you say tourists, Mr. Chair, do you mean out-of-state visitors?
Yeah. And so I can put that on the record so no one misinterprets that. I do not want us to even consider repeating the travesty we had when we tried to differentiate fees between residents and outside residents.
That's not why the question's being asked.
Mr. Chair, we'll work on that. I can give you the today information. We'll see what we can dig up.
There might be some estimates back there. Yeah. And any that you can provide from the historical would be helpful. So,
Mr. Chair, just one more comment.
Yes.
I wanted to flag something. You had mentioned regarding the ATVs, you might be kind of starting to look at some of the safety issues and things. And I believe I just wanted to highlight there is a Senate bill that's out there that has some proposals. I met the grandmother of Kyle. It's called Kyle's Law. I met her last night, and so you might be aware of the bills there. I'm not sure who the sponsor is.
Yeah, I'm
oh, the sponsor. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
And the State Parks is the sponsor of four more bills. So.
Freshman, Mr. Chair.
If you let him finish, I think he was about to say approach the bill with great caution.
But I think that will be a very interesting discussion. I think there are some issues that need to be addressed. I know that there's some outstanding issues there that users want to see addressed also. But I think there's some compromises that can be reached on reasonable people. So
I do have one last question about ATVs. The Oregon Dunes, is that administered by BLM? Because I was under the impression it was part of the state park system.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, that's managed by the U.S. Forest Service.
Oh, it is? Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting, because that's pretty extensive ATV usage.
Yes. We have no state parks properties which are used for ATV recreation. We have some properties that are adjacent to, like the Honeyman State Park is adjacent to the dunes, and we have some connections there. Umpqua Lighthouse State Park, same way. But we don't have any state parks where that have ATV recreation as one of the activities that occur there.
Any final questions?
Yes. Well, yes, I just thought of one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wood, one other thing, speaking about BLM, the BLM in Central Oregon is working on a very large fuel reduction project in the Lupine area, which includes Lupine State Park, and I've read the correspondence between your department and the Bureau regarding that, and there were some concerns expressed by your department's forester, and I was just curious whether or not you've been able to get those issues resolved so that project could move forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I'm not exactly sure what the status is on that. I know that the discussions are going on. We do have some concerns about the vulnerability and the ability to manage those forests down there, because it's kind of a strange relationship we have. They own the trees and we own the land. We fully recognize the need to be able to have some latitude in reducing the fire hazard in that area.
Thank you.
I'll get back to you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Very cool. Department of Forestry.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. With me is Satish Upadhyay, who is with Budget and Management. And we handed out a paper backgrounder this morning. I'm going to use that to walk through an outline of the department's overview, just hitting the highlights, and hopefully do that quickly enough to meet your schedule. So, first part of the backgrounder talks about the forest resource in general. Oregon's about 50% forested, obviously very important in the state. Just wanted to point out a couple of things there. It's not hype when we say that Oregon has some of the most productive forest lands in the world. They are, in fact, on the coastal range, some of the most productive forest lands in the world, and that is significant. Land use policies that have been in place for a number of years now have done a good job of maintaining working forests in the state, and we're concerned about that issue. There's folks who will say that the industry in the state is diminishing, but it's important to note, for example, that we are still the number one producer of lumber in the United States, so it is still significant, not only for the rural parts of Oregon, but it's significant in the United States that we're involved to that level, and we have those kinds of forests. The ownership is roughly, can be characterized, about 60% of Oregon's forests are owned by the federal government, and that is pervasive in a way it impacts how we try to manage these resources. The bulk of the remainder is privately owned, split between the larger industrial type owners and the smaller family forest land owners. The state of Oregon, we manage about 3% of the forest is all, and the tribal interests also have some forest land and counties that they manage. The significant, I guess, theme that we operate under, and you'll see this reflected in all of our communications and in all of our work with the legislature, with public and everything, is the notion of forest sustainability. That to be sustainable in a state like Oregon, across all of our multiple ownerships and our diverse regions, forests need to be able to provide a pretty robust suite of environmental benefits, economic benefits, and social benefits, that all three of those sets of values are very important to have sustainable forests in the state. And you have to look at whether that's being provided across all ownerships, and need to understand that it's not about coming into a room and arguing for your piece of the pie, whether you're an economic interest or an environmental interest or a social interest. It's about coming into the room and understanding that all three of those sets of values are very dependent on each other. That if you don't have economic value in the forest, then you cannot afford to provide environmental protections or social values. And if you don't protect the environmental values, then you're undercutting what basically produces cash, you know, the basic soil and water resources and biological resources. And if you don't provide the social values, then there's not the emotional commitment on the part of people to protect these lands for any reason. So they are dependent on each other, and we use that as the principle, the core belief in our agency and within the Board of Forestry. Just to go on to a couple other pieces here. I'll start with the Board of Forestry. I know we're going to have to move on quickly. Board of Forestry is statutorily responsible for all forest policy issues in the state. They're responsible for adopting the rules that implement the state's Forest Practices Act, and they are responsible for hiring and supervising the state forester, me. They have a strategic document that I believe was delivered to all of you yesterday in a larger backgrounder package called the Forestry Program for Oregon, and that essentially is the document by which they guide their policymaking and decision-making processes. It was approved in 2003 and is intended to be renewed in 2011. There are seven members. Four of those members currently are appointments are have expired, and they're due to they can either be reappointed or replaced by the governor. And if there's no questions on the board, maybe I will move on to the department. I know we're not talking about budget, but just to give you some sense of scale, we have about 800 permanent full-time year-round positions. During the fire season, we add another 400 or so seasonal firefighter positions. We have a biennial budget recommendation from the governor that's about $266 million. Within that, we have primarily three programs. We kind of look at them as three businesses. One is fire protection. It is the largest program in the agency. The next is all of our work on private forest lands. That includes assistance and forest practices regulatory activities. And the third is managing state-owned lands. And then in addition to that, we've got some other things that we do, such as working in urban and community forestry environments. Just to dig into each of the programs a little bit more, on the Protecting from Fire program, our responsibility covers 16 million acres in the state. The federal agencies protect another, basically the remainder of the forest land that's under protection in the state. We work very cooperatively with the federal agencies. It's a key part of being successful is creating a constructive cooperative relationship with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Our program overall is essentially trying to contain costs and be effective. That's what firefighting's all about. Our primary method for doing that is to be well-staffed for initial attack. We feel like attacking the fires quickly, aggressively, when they're still small, in the end, it's the best investment to keep from expending large amounts of money later on when the fires get very large and very difficult to fight. There is a growing set of concerns around the interface between forest and urban areas, wildland urban interface, and we've got several programs that deal with that, including implementation of Senate Bill 360, which requires that we work with counties and local communities to develop a community wildfire protection approach that encourages landowners to treat their properties to be more fire safe. It's working really well. It's been fully implemented in two counties and is in the process of being implemented in another four or six, I think, at this point. I can't remember exactly. But it's been very effective at bringing all the parties together and really raising awareness on this issue of having a fire-safe residential areas in amongst forests. I'll move on to private forests. That's about 40% of the state. Again, about half of those are owned by the larger industrial interests who focus on timber management in a environmentally sustainable manner. The other half are family forest landowners who own their land for a lot of different reasons that can certainly include timber management, but also recreation and just aesthetic value and wildlife benefits and just having them. The Forest Practices Act is our primary interaction with private landowners, and it requires any time a landowner is going to conduct a timber harvest that we be notified and that they follow certain standards that include protecting stream resources, carrying out reforestation, providing some wildlife benefits, in some cases dealing with aesthetic issues and other things. Our on-the-ground forest that deals with that are called stewardship foresters. And they, as you can see here, contacted about 1,200 landowners last year that were working on 95,000 acres. Those people are really key to carrying out this program effectively. And we had a really good discussion during the interim with the interim House Ag and Natural Resources Committee about how a reduction of capacity amongst this field force affects our ability to implement the Forest Practices Act. And the way I would kind of describe that discussion overall is that Oregon has really focused on trying to work with landowners so that we can help them be successful. We haven't really described ourselves as a regulatory enforcement, we're going to try to catch people doing the wrong thing agency. We have tried to fashion ourselves as people who are out there on the ground trying to help people be successful across the whole range of objectives they're trying to meet, which obviously include following the law. And we've had a significant reduction in those field forces over the last several biennium because of budget constraints. And the discussion in the interim was around the fact that we're at danger of losing that ability to be helpful by not having those positions out there. And so I hope we can have a good discussion about that, you know, as we go forward in the budget later this year. We also manage some incentive funds to provide landowners payments so that they can do specific things like plant trees. We have a real strong commitment to monitoring the effectiveness of the Forest Practices Act to find out whether, in fact, it is providing the water quality protection, wildlife benefits, and so forth that we're striving for. We are significantly involved in the Oregon Plan for Salmon Watershed, and we also are responsible for forest insect and disease suppression and prevention activities in the state. We have an emerging effort to try to get landowners more engaged in the notion of carbon sequestration and its beneficial impacts on global warming, but also as a market opportunity in the future. There are places around the country and the world that have developed market opportunities for landowners around the ability to store carbon. I'd say we are just in the very, very early stages of trying to get to that point. We have operate on a strictly revenue neutral, I guess is the way I would put it, situation, a seed tree bank where we actually develop seed for a cooperative of private landowners. It's strictly funded out of the receipts from that activity. And it's not mentioned here, but I will also say in our budget is the notation of the state nursery, the Phipps Nursery in Douglas County. And I should let you know that, in fact, we are in the process, the very, very first stages of selling the state nursery. That, we're going to have to continue to operate it until we do sell it. It could take, it could take 18 months, 2 years. We don't know exactly, but we are in the process of getting out of that business. So. The state forest, I'll move on there. We manage almost 800,000 acres. It is managed for a range of values. The Board of what we call the Board of Forestry lands are a portion of those holdings, and what are known as the Common School Fund lands are the other portion. They have two distinctly different statutory mandates. The mandate for the Board of Forestry lands is called the Greatest Permanent Value, and the Board of Forestry spends a substantial amount of time dealing with whether or not we are effectively delivering greatest permanent value on those lands and what that means and how you measure it. The Common School Fund lands have as their mandate to deliver funds to the Common School Fund in a manner that is sustainable over the long term and meets good conservation and environmental practices. There's a printout here showing our revenue history over the last 10 years or so. You can see on the Board of Forestry lands, the returns go to counties, and their receipts are as high as they've ever been over the last several years, in fact, higher than they've ever been, I believe. The Common School Fund revenues have been challenged a little bit last year, and there's a lot of different reasons for that, we did fall under the 5-year and the 10-year average last year. So if you look the year before, we were actually well above both the 5-year and 10-year average, so part of it is the timing under which receipts come in. this is probably the area that whenever, if we're going to make the newspapers, it's about 90% of the time about managing public lands. That's part of the business. There's lots of controversy around managing public lands. We have tried to construct our interaction with all that around the notion that it's a constant conversation. We're always want to be listening. We always want to be trying to improve what we're doing. And in the end, we always want to be working on being absolutely successful in each and every respect. It's not, again, about trying to favor any set of values over another. We want to be successful in every set of values. That's probably an impossible goal, but I think it's the right one that we need to keep striving towards. One of the things I'll highlight in addition on state land is just our recreation activity that is important to a lot of people. There are some folks who have at times felt like our being involved in recreation on these lands represents somewhat of a competition against our ability to do other things like manage for timber. I think it's important that we do pay attention to the recreation opportunities on these lands and to the people who want us to provide recreation. And I think, you know, it's part, of this concept that it's about delivering all three sets of value in an integrated way. And when we're successful at integrating hiking and camping and picnicking and bird watching and all these things, you know, on lands that are working for us, that are in fact harvesting timber and producing revenue, I think we're creating the right message about how lands should be well utilized. You know, because forests are a limited resource, and we've got to share them. We've got to find ways to for all of this to be produced on the same acres, or and we can't really afford to keep letting people set aside this part for their need and that part for their need and this part for their need. I think the more we can integrate those and make that a successful integration, the better we are in the future. Just move on to the last couple of more minor programs, urban and community forestry. And there's a chart there that shows Oregon's population and how it's changed from 1900 to 2000. In 1900, 32% of the population was urban. In 2000, it's 80%. And that right there speaks volumes about how pressures on forest lands are changing, and also perceptions about forest lands are changing. People who live in cities simply do not have the same connection with forest resources that people who live out in the rural areas. And to bridge both of those challenges, both being able to connect with urban populations and being able to deal with the pressures that come from urban populations constantly needing to expand somewhere, which is often into forested areas, we feel like we need to look at a more, I guess I'd call it, robust urban and community forestry program at some point, one that really allows us to get involved with that issue and create a better result than we've seen so far. We also have a forest resource planning program that supports many of the board's long-range policy issues, such as how do we try to create a stronger voice in federal land management for the state? How do we continually measure the health and well-being of our forests and report that to people in ways that make a difference to them? How do we provide you all and others information about the success of the land use program and other things? That's very, very fast, but I'll stop.
Representative Durant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment to the committee. During the past interim, all of us, as legislators on occasion, have that opportunity to call the director of an agency and ask for help. We had a situation during this past interim that there was an RFP issued by this department that was slightly altered from the past one. All of us have our districts that have firefighters involved, and it's on a contractual basis with this agency. Due to the change in the RFP, 19 different districts in this state did not fill out the RFP correctly and lost the contract with the state. That included 170 firefighters in my district who suddenly were out of a job and were contemplating at the fact that a firefighting group in Salem was going to be awarded the contract for fighting forest fires in Klamath Falls. I got on the phone with Mr. Brown, explained the situation, and within 72 hours there was a new RFP issued, which all 19 districts in the state responded to properly this time,
and contracts were awarded on time and back to the local entities. I just wanted to commend Mr. Brown and put it on the record for the committee that this is, to me, the kind of a response and interplay between our directors and the legislature that is extremely beneficial, and I wanted to publicly thank Mr. Brown for his efforts and what he did. I wish all agencies would respond as well and as quickly as you did. Thank you, Mr. Brown. So.
Chair Devlin, Representative Gerard, you're very kind, but I'll take it. Thank
you. Yes, Senator Nelson.
Two questions. Basically, on page 3 of your big overview where you have the graph of annual timber harvest, I guess this is a comment for the committee, but also I'm looking for the connection here. The downturn in the federal forest in the early 1990s and harvesting the federal forest basically parallels a downturn in our ability to fund public services. I've seen graphs someplace along the line. Probably the department, I don't know if you keep any economic data along those lines, but on an inflation-adjusted basis, our ability to fund public programs, and I'm looking at the overall picture. If the system needs more money, one of the things that we've lost in this whole process is the ability to use some of a very good natural resource, and I think it connects to a lot of other things. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that or.
It's Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson. Yeah, the like I said, 60% of Oregon's forests are federally owned, and their impact on the state is profound, and it shows up economically, really severely in eastern Oregon, particularly because actually east of the mountains, 72% of the forest land is owned by the federal government, and Representative Burley probably knows the statistics better than I do in terms of how many mills have shut down since the early 90s in eastern Oregon, but it's been significant, and they're not back, and that has a big influence on rural communities. The same kind of impacts are felt on this side of the state as well, though, because in a given year, if the mill capacity that we have right now is running anywhere near normal, they look at roughly a half a billion board foot per year shortage in standing timber to run their mills effectively with the capacity, just normal capacity we have right now. And that wood has to be brought in at a much higher cost from places like British Columbia, New Zealand, if you can believe it. The state with the most productive forest land in the world is importing wood to keep our industry going, so it's significant.
Follow up on kind of a related argument. We're talking about the carbon credits and global warming. I think that's really a crucial issue, and I think we'll be doing that. There's an inverse impact, and it's kind of related to the fact that we're not doing some reasonable cutting. My understanding is that in a forest fire, say like the Biscuit Forest Fire early on, that there was like 6 times as much carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere in a month's time or however long that fire went than there was produced in the whole state of Oregon. Does the department have any facts and figures on if you have a major forest fire, what happens? I mean, how much carbon dioxide actually gets pumped into the air?
It's Senator Devlin and Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson. Intuitively, everything you're saying is right, and I'm sure there is data out there that shows a lot of that. It's a science that that's pretty not very mature, I guess is the way I put it. So you get data that can be all over the board, but in general, the notion of thinning forests and taking that wood and converting it to a renewable energy has some significant benefits to, you know, the overall carbon budget versus allowing those forests to burn and emit carbon dioxide and all the smoke into the air. I mean, intuitively, that makes a big difference, and it's one of the things that we talk about quite a bit in terms of the benefits, both for thinning and also for, you know, kind of managing fuels.
Chairman, if the committee doesn't want this explanation now, I could take it privately afterwards at some point. But I'm kind of interested in the state nursery decision and how that came about. There's probably a history that you all know and I don't. So however you'd like to handle that, Mr. Chair.
Chair Devlin, I can give a real short answer and then follow up. But the short answer is that by statute, the nursery has to be self-supporting. And the business plan there has been problematic for a number of years now. And in fact, the longer we keep it open, the more money we're going to lose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see we've got 4 minutes, so. but to follow up on Senator Nelson's comment, I cannot overemphasize how important that chart on page 3 is, because some of the eastern Oregon counties, the ones I'm most familiar with, prior to that decline in federal timber output, were receiving as much as $9 million a year on average in 25% federal timber harvest receipts, and that money by law was dedicated to schools and roads. So here we are today trying to get the Secure Rural Schools Act reauthorized in Congress, which, frankly, I have very little optimism is going to happen. And what we need to be doing instead is looking at a natural resource that we have available to us. I think the charts on page, the first page under the Oregon State Forest, it talks about the Board of Forestry and Common School Lands is very telling. Representative Hunt and I have been co-chairing a work group during the interim trying to figure out how we might be able to come up with some capital funds for K-12, and the Common School Fund is something that we look at as a possibility. And the question is, how can we get more revenues in there? And the answer is, we manage more of the forest, because 85% of our common school revenue right now is from forestry. And I also had the opportunity to review the LC draft that the governor's prepared on trying to get the authority to be able to buy these large blocks of working forest land, which I think is a very valid idea and concept, with the notion that it be dedicated for funding for higher education. And one of the comments I have, Mr. Brown, is that, you know, the state of Washington went through this with the DNR lands, which are held in trust for higher education. There were lawsuits filed claiming that the state was not meeting its statutory mandate. So if the governor's bill is going to move forward, I'd like to see that we've got some pretty tight language in there that says if these lands are purchased for that purpose, it's very clear what that purpose is for.
Sir,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's a difficult question since I've got about 2 minutes left.
Technically, I mean, you're listed as, this is a softball question. I'll ask the harder one when you come back. You're listed as the director of the State Department of Forestry. Sometimes you're referred to as the State Forester. We had this discussion a little bit in terms of your role being much broader than simply the state forest lands, in terms of your role relative to private forest lands. Do you feel also that your department and you should be in some capacity advising the legislature and the governor on our relationship with the federal government and the management of their lands?
Chair Devlin, yes, I do.
That's a softball question.
you know, it's if my job is to try to promote a sustainable forest resource in the state of Oregon, you can't do that and ignore federal lands.
Yeah,
they're just, the interrelationships are too deep, and the ability to influence what happens on those lands is not an easy place to go. It's something we're trying to get to on a number of different fronts. I will make one comment on the state forester thing. I usually refer to myself as a director because that's what you deal with, are directors, and that's what I am. The state forester title is a throwback to way back when the federal government was actually implementing their programs that originally funneled money into the states to start state forestry programs, and that was a a title designation in federal statute that the state forester is the one who will receive these funds and interact with the Forest Service. And so every state went about, you know, creating that title. And that's all it is. So you can call me whatever you want.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd also like to recognize Mr. Brown as being the president.
Past
president of our professional society, the Society of American Foresters, which I think is a great distinction. Congratulations.
Well, with that, what a pleasant way to end the meeting. We are adjourned. Tomorrow.